Hey everybody, Eric Trexler here. It is Wednesday night. It is 7 p.m. Eastern Time. That means it's time for Mass Office Hours, brought to you by the Mass Research Review. I am here with the good Dr. Eric Helms. Helms, how is life on the other side of the planet?
You know, I can't complain. And one big, really cool piece of news is I've actually got a PhD student who is now briefly living with me while he finds a flat named Takahiro Itagaki from Japan, who first reached out to me in 2019 to come out the next year. Mild things interrupted that, like a global pandemic, but we've got him out here now, 2024, and his PhD topic is going to be looking if we can predict hypertrophy from proxy measures. So I'm excited. I'm living with another bodybuilder who is also a muscle nerd, and bright future here down under, where we are trying to figure out how to get jacked.
Yeah, and how to predict how to get jacked.
Yes, which is a challenge, as you know. It's something we've talked about many times.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really interesting. It's nice. I feel like more and more I'm hearing about very ambitious PhD topics related to bodybuilding. You know, it used to be back in the day, say, hey, what are you going to do? Be like, I'm going to run a training study and then report it. You know, and that's nothing to sneeze at, by the way. A training study is a brutal endeavor. If you've ever thought, hey, how hard can it be? Think about it. Just start sketching out the hours and how to organize all the communication. It's brutal. But yeah, so no slight to the training studies. I did one really big one in grad school, and it was brutal. But yeah, nowadays people are like really sinking their teeth into some ambitious topics that are going to move the field forward. I'm excited.
Yeah, this will almost sound arrogant, but the idea of standing on the shoulders of giants, you don't even necessarily need to be giants. It's really just standing on the short shoulders of slightly getting higher and higher each time in research. And I think that has become really clear to me now that I'm a little more than a decade into my research. Like, the things I was able to do were informed by what came before, and vice versa. And it's just a really kind of a cool thing to see that the stuff we were doing 10 years ago is now allowing like this next step. Like, okay, well, cool. We understand the general way things go, but how do we individualize it? How do we predict things? How do we move beyond the typical limitations of some of this stuff to be more useful? So yeah, no, 100% agree.
And you know what the weirdest thing is? I was thinking about this today, not being cynical, not being grumpy, but I was being cynical, but the interesting thing about a field that's growing rapidly and really maturing is that it doesn't happen in a uniform way, right? So like if you think about a window of like where the field was 10 years ago, and there's this spectrum of like the best work in the field to the worst work in the field, it's not like that whole thing just shifts over when a field gets better, right? What really happens is there are some people who are like really pushing it forward, and then the bad stuff lags behind hard. So the window gets wider in terms of like the variance of quality. I was just thinking about that because if you're a Mass subscriber, I'm writing an article right now that I am absolutely beside myself writing. It is wild. I don't want to give it away, but it's one of those papers where you look at it and you say, you mean to tell me that an editor and two reviewers were okay with this, right? And so that'll be coming in approximately 1 month in the next issue of Mass. But anyway, yeah, I was thinking today about like, man, I know people who are doing remarkable work in our field right now, and this, you know, is still happening too.
Well, Trex, I have it on good authority that because of those really poor pieces of work that are lagging behind, that we should actually be throwing out all of the good stuff. Yes. I don't know if that makes logical sense to you, but it absolutely does to me.
Yeah. You know what? Yeah, I was thinking of it more of like a distribution of quality, but I like yours better. The worst to judge the rest and throw it out.
It works well in society. It works well in social environments. You know, you simply just, you basically judge everything based upon the worst common denominator and apply that to life, and you'll be a happy, healthy person with a functional society every single time. That's the way that works.
Absolutely. All right, well, folks, that was an impromptu discussion about the state of research and whether or not you can use it for anything. If you like what we do here and you want to support the show, There are many ways to do it. We're so glad that you joined us. While you're here, go ahead and like the video right now while you're at it on YouTube watching us live. If you're watching later, still make sure you like it, rate, subscribe, review, all that good stuff. Tell a friend, send them a link to our YouTube, our Spotify, our Apple Podcasts. If you want to submit a question to make the show better, literally to participate in making the show good, you can do that at massresearchreview.com/officehours. That link is in the description of today's episode. And of course, the best way to participate in this show is to join in on the fun live. So we are here 7 p.m. Eastern Time Wednesday nights, and we would love to see you in the chat and answer your questions. Now, Helms, we have surely some fantastic questions to get to in the chat. But before we get to the live chat, we wanted to talk a little bit about the psychology of refeeds. Now, refeeds, you know, we're talking about the research 10 years ago. I remember writing about refeeds in research 10 years ago and saying, hey, here's the thing people do, but we don't know anything about it and there's no research, so take it with a grain of salt. Well, things have changed. People have done research on refeeds. It's a topic where you and I have both kind of shifted our perspectives as more data have become available over the years. So why don't you take us away and talk a little bit about the psychological side of refeeds rather than the physiology that we always dig into?
Yeah, I think, you know, the funny thing is bodybuilders often focus on the physiological outcomes because they generally are people willing to do anything to get to their goals, or at least that's the perception, which is not strictly true, or natural bodybuilding wouldn't exist. But I think and some people would claim it doesn't, but hey, no, people wouldn't even be on low dosages, right? So, which is, anyway, I'm getting off topic. The point being is that oftentimes bodybuilders themselves are people interested in maximizing an outcome, even if they're not competitors. Really, sometimes, traditionally, in my experience, in the evidence-based community, kind of go, whatever about the psychology, I'll sort that out. Don't you worry about it. Is this going to, like, bottom line me, is this going to make a difference? Yeah. But something that is also true is that if you put someone through the process of bodybuilding contest prep, most people, at least early in their career, will find something that is at least approaching their breaking point of the stress they can tolerate. Especially if they took a really traditional approach, did a crash diet, had to get really, really lean, or had never really dieted before. And something that is often reported is that refeeds, cheat meals, or other intermittent dieting strategies can trigger binge eating episodes, or maybe not true binges, but at least unrestricted eating that basically becomes a barrier to success for contest prep. So for some people, and some coaches will say for some clients, they try to identify whether or not you can do refeeds because for this person, you know what, it might set them back. And given that we're also seeing mixed data, or at least I'd say incomplete data as to the potential utility of refeeds from a physiological perspective, I think we have more work to do there to really investigate that, to be honest. And all the data right now is indicating a potential psychological adherence or appetite management benefit when we look at the data on diet breaks, for example. I think it's really important to explore the other side of refeeds. So, okay, we've got some data that suggests, coming out of both Dr. Bill Campbell's lab and also Jackson Pios's PhD, that these, you know, diet breaks, a week long, taking a week off of dieting, might enhance adherence. But then we have these anecdotes of people who are saying, yeah, but for some people, man, these can really go south. So I think that's something that really needs to be addressed, because while the average response to something like this in a research setting might be positive for adherence, it's just too common of a anecdote that you'll hear to leave it unexplored. So there was a pretty cool study that I reviewed in the Mass issue that just dropped like 3 days ago, that was done by Desmarais and colleagues, titled Relation Between Adaptive Eating and Energy Intake Coping Strategies in a Refeed Model for Bodybuilders. And this research design was cool because it specifically looked at continuous relationships. So they didn't have necessarily two interventions they were comparing, but they looked at the relationship between certain personality traits and then how many calories that actual bodybuilders during contest prep consumed when having an ad libitum meal as part of a refeed strategy. And this is probably the only study that I'm aware of that's really specific to bodybuilding, where we're trying to, you know, untangle what are the personality characteristics and the mindset and perspective as they relate to eating and coping with stress that are related to how big is that ad libitum meal going to be? Is it going to be a free meal? Is it going to be a cheat meal? Or is it going to be a holy crap, I just had a full day of eating's worth for a normal sized human in one sitting? So,
yeah. Because there has been some really fascinating research that we review. I'm pretty sure we reviewed it in Mass at least a year or two ago, looking at cheat meals. Actually, I don't think I did a Mass review on that one specifically. I've just alluded to it. But there has been published research about cheat meals, and they did a fun thing. It was really creative, but they just searched the hashtag cheat meal on Instagram. And what they did was kind of looked at the, you know, what kind of psychological insights can we glean from what we're seeing in these posts? And the first insight was that a lot of people use cheat meals and cheat days and love to talk about it and show it on Instagram. And so there was this kind of idea of like, well, what does it look like when a fitness enthusiast cheats and calls it that? And man, some of the meals were just absolutely, I mean, they're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of calories, sometimes, you know, upwards of like 7,000 or 8,000 calories that are pictured in the image. So we've seen a little glimpse of like what a cheat meal looks like. But like you said, we've never really seen this refeed focus thing in bodybuilders specifically. So so what do we find here?
Yeah, I think before we get directly in the findings, we do need to talk about terminology, because a lot of people say the same thing but mean different things, right? So importantly, this was a study that was published in Portuguese and translated to English. So the terminology that they actually used in the manuscript was cheat meals, and they described them as ad libitum meals as a part of a refeed. And that in and of itself, depending upon the terminology used, is a little confusing, but then I'm also not sure exactly the connotation of the specific Portuguese terminology that was used. So I'll describe what they did, and then we'll decide whether we think that's a cheat meal or a refeed or some combination of the two. Yeah. All right, so we got these experienced bodybuilders. That's an important first thing to mention. They were around 30 years old on average. They've been training for more than a decade, and they'd all done on average 6 or 7 competitions. 14 male bodybuilders from Brazil. So it's a relatively specific sample. So, you know, there are some limitations here. And they were given guidance during the first 4 weeks of their contest prep to follow a 5-2 setup. Not the 5-2 where you got 2 dieting days, but the 5-2 that's often used in bodybuilding circles, where Monday through Friday you're on low calorie days, where you're trying to accumulate your deficit and lose fat, and then 2 days at a refeed that is intended to be closer to maintenance calories. The specific guidance they got was to try to achieve a 40% energy deficit on their low days. They're given individualized diet plans relative to their peak off-season intakes in the last week of their off-season. And then the refeed days, they were given guidance to consume primarily carbohydrate and to eat a similar number of structured meals, increase their calories, and do this via an ad libitum meal. But it does seem like this wasn't a true cheat meal, because the cheat meals that we often see, like you described in social media, they're not low fat. Let me just put it that way. But when these bodybuilders reported their, when the researchers reported the bodybuilders' average intakes, they were still consuming reasonable intakes on the refeed days. It didn't wash out their deficit. It got them down from, say, like on average a 44% energy deficit or reduction in calories from off season to low days down to in the mid 20s. So they weren't eating so much in a surplus or maintenance that it was wiping out their accumulated deficit from those 5 days, and they were still consuming about 70% of their calories from carbohydrate on the refeed days. So they're presumably given some guidance that more resembles refeeds in practice. So refeeds, as we actually wrote about in our updated nutrition guidelines for bodybuilders, sits on the middle of the spectrum from cheat meals to diet breaks as far as how controlled this intake is going to be and what we're trying to accomplish. A cheat meal is typically an ad libitum meal where you're not tracking and there's no restrictions on the food. and it can get pretty big. And it may make that day into a surplus maintenance or at least a smaller deficit. And the intention is to have less control over it to give you a break, right? A refeed is traditionally a maintenance or surplus energy intake with guidance on what that specific energy intake is. And a diet break is typically a break from dieting, not necessarily a surplus, where you're at maintenance and you're actually given more specific calorie guidance and it lasts longer. So the level of a break from the behaviors of dieting is scaling down as you move from the cheat meal where you can eat whatever you want, not worrying about it. It's just like, hey, eat this meal and pretend it never happened and go about your day. The refeed, we might be purposely going into a surplus, but it's quantified. Could be maintenance as well, depending. And then a diet break is we're not trying to backslide at all. We're hitting pause. We're taking a break from the diet. We're not breaking the diet like unintentionally. So this did operate as refeeds, but it interestingly included quote-unquote cheat meals or at least ad libitum meals. But I would say it probably is sitting somewhere between a cheat meal and a refeed because of the guidance they were given, and they were actually tracking their energy intake. So it's a tracked cheat meal that was in the context of a refeed that didn't abolish the energy deficit. What do you want to call that? That's up to you. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And I think that design is important because what we're not observing here is a truly free meal. It may have become that for some of these participants, but the fact that they were being observed, they were reporting into the researchers, and they had to actually quantify their energy intake is certainly impacting the outcomes to some degree. And I think that's an important limitation or at least caveat to understanding the findings. All right. So with that said, the principal things we're looking at, and I'm going to focus on the things that actually popped as being statistically related to outcomes that are of interest, because there was some other measurements, which I don't think were that particularly interesting. Like they measured changes in anthropometry and like, yes, they got generally leaner over 4 weeks of dieting. Okay, who cares? There was no compare group, right? There wasn't like we can say refeeds were better than not. They also measured markers of general stress, which, yeah, they got worse as they dieted for 4 weeks. Not that interesting. Again, there's no comparative group.
So, although to their credit, sometimes it is nice to see that in even in a single group longitudinal study. So, for example, 100%. Sometimes you'll say, "Oh, people weren't stressed when they were dieting." It's like, well, how were they dieting? You know, were they losing weight? Were they, you know,
very true.
Sometimes it's good to get a marker on how this was progressing,
especially in the early stages of just understanding something that is very outside of normal stuff,
yeah,
like bodybuilding. Like some of the early case studies in bodybuilders were incredibly important just so we could go like, okay, bodybuilders say this is hard, but how hard is it for a bodybuilder getting shredded if we use the profile of mood states?
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Pretty bad. It's like five-fold the normal stress levels. And that was one of the first case studies that published in 2011, you know?
Yeah.
Very important for just kind of profiling the occurrence of something. And there's even a really great review that I was a part of on what are the effects of contest prep when we compile all those case studies together. And so this work does start to really give us a clear picture of how do we quantify the effects of what people are talking about anecdotally. And it's kind of moving up the observational research ladder in the hierarchy of evidence above pure anecdotes and actually giving us quantifiable numbers. And it allows us to then know what we're dealing with, to then, going back to the start of this episode, standing on the shoulders of those who came before. So anyway, the really interesting stuff that gives us some potentially practical insights of what we can do as coaches or athletes or for a screening tool, perhaps, for deciding who maybe should be using an approach like this, was they gave a number of psychrometric scales prior to each one of these free meals. And they also asked them to rate their hunger levels prior to each one of these free meals. And then they simply looked at the relationships between these psychrometric scales as well as hunger with the amount of calories that ended up being consumed. So we can have some understanding of what is influencing calorie intake during a free meal, right? So they gave them a number of different psychometrics. One of them was a psychometric scale on mindful eating, which is essentially just how mindful of you are you during the eating process. So are you aware of what food looks like, how it tastes? Are you distracted? Are you eating past satisfaction, which might indicate you're kind of disinhibited and not too focused on the experience and more just eating far past what your signals might tell you? Are you eating in response to emotion, or are you being impacted by external cues like advertisements? And they were also given what's called an intuitive eating subscale. And intuitive eating is a specific thing, even though we have a colloquial understanding of what intuitive eating is, like I'm eating intuitively. Intuitive eating is specifically related to how well someone eats while considering their interoceptive awareness, which means how well are they aware of their body signals, how food makes them feel, whether they're eating for physical rather than emotional reasons, and how much confidence they have in those signals. That's kind of a big picture way of looking at what intuitive eating is. And for some background, intuitive eating is a relatively recent development, and it is a clinical tool used by some dietitians and eating behaviorists to work with people who have eating disorders. Many people with eating disorders and many eating disorders, but not all, especially those related to bulimia or binge eating disorder or certain disordered eating patterns, follow a pattern where someone is restricting, which prospectively predicts binge eating. The restriction is often co-varying with some type of body image dissatisfaction that is driving that disordered eating pattern as a way to try to modify one's body composition. And it results in this kind of cyclical pattern where there's shame in response to binging and then restriction, which prompts further binging. And unfortunately, this can be a vicious cycle. And one of the ways you can break that cycle, or one of the tools used to do it, is an intuitive eating coaching framework where you're hopefully getting someone to give themselves unconditional permission to eat. However, are we back?
Yeah.
I see you on the thing.
Live. We're good. Okay. So, Helms.
All right.
Here's what happened for all the people that are still with us. Tragedy struck. I'm plugged in with Ethernet. So, what that tells me is that the entire internet to my house just kind of glitched there for a minute. But thanks to everyone who stuck with us there, and we should be back and good to go. That happens from time to time. And then it usually doesn't happen repeatedly. So, let's lock in. Helms, you were talking about refeeds.
Yes.
And let's dive right back in.
Do you remember the last thing I said? Because I was monologuing and I didn't notice until it shut down.
I don't know, because I've been frantically hitting buttons and twisting wires over here. But
I got you.
If memory serves, you know, you had talked about, you had covered the fact that this is in a bodybuilding population, which is a unique approach. You had discussed plenty of definitions. You had talked about intuitive eating and how that's a tool that's often used by dietitians, and it's often used with folks with some degree of body image dissatisfaction. And I think we're kind of leaving off right around there.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for that. So yeah, intuitive eating is important to frame a little bit, because there is intuitive eating as an intervention, which is teaching people to listen to their bodies and to try to satisfy not only their emotional needs, but also their physical needs, and to give themselves unconditional permission to eat in that context. So this is intended to break the cycle of restriction, which is often coming from a sense of shame around one's body, and then overeating that is prompted by the restriction, which comes from shame associated with binge eating and not being able to follow the restricted diet they had. So in both cases, where they're restricting initially and then when they're binge eating, they're satisfying neither their physical nor their emotional needs. So that as a therapy is a weight neutral approach designed to help people out of a cycle of disordered eating patterns. However, the intuitive eating scale that is used measures people's natural ability, if you will, or coached ability perhaps, to do intuitive eating. Are you aware of how food makes you feel? Do you have a generally restrictive approach to what you're quote-unquote allowed to eat? Do you have trust in your satiety and hunger signals? And it measures other components like that of your eating behavior and your perception. That's essentially the other scale. So they measured mindfulness around eating, intuitive eating ability, and then finally they also measured, in addition to hunger, they measured how people cope with stress, which fell under three different domains: problem-focused coping, emotion-focused coping, or avoidance-focused coping. And that just means that what is your dominant pattern and what are you good at when you try to deal with stress? You try to change the problem, change the thing in front of you. So problem-focused coping would be a strategy to change the situation. That's a little more active. It's something you couldn't really do in this scenario anyway. You're given a protocol, you got to do it. Avoidance-focused coping, and I'm skipping emotion for a reason, is when you just remove yourself from the problem altogether. It's not always necessarily maladaptive. You know, if you're in a dysfunctional relationship or environment, not being a part of it anymore, that can be very useful. But sometimes avoidance-focused coping could be seen as conflict-avoidant, and it sometimes conflicts with problem-focused coping. And then finally, a really relevant one is emotion-focused coping, which is saying, hey, regardless of the situation, whether I'm trying to change it or remove myself from it, I'm getting an emotional response to the stress. And how good am I at using strategies to manage those emotions? Okay. And there's a reason why I went into that in that order. So what they specifically found was that, very unsurprisingly, the hungrier you were prior to one of your ad libitum feeding meals had a very strong relationship, around a 0.9 out of 1 score for how much you prospectively ate in terms of calories. But what I found was really interesting is that the second strongest relationship was around, I think, a 0.8, if I recall correctly. I don't have it directly in front of me. Was their intuitive eating score overall. And this was essentially that the greater your intuitive eating score, the lower the calorie intake was. And I think when some people think about intuitive eating, especially if they kind of have a negative connotation towards it, they're like, oh, you're just going to eat when you emotionally want to. If I did that, I would intuitively eat myself into obesity. You know, you hear that sometimes, and I think that's kind of a misunderstanding of what intuitive eating is.
Yeah.
It was the exact opposite relationship of that. Now, as far as the context and why I'm framing this as a positive, this is directly informed by when you look at the magnitude of calories consumed in this meal across these 14 individuals. It basically spanned from around 600 to 700 calories, eyeballing the graphs, all the way up to slightly over 2,000. So I find it counterproductive to typical energy intakes that are appropriate for one meal on a refeed day when you're eating 5 to 7 meals like these guys were, to eat 1,500 to 2,000 calories. And it makes a lot more sense in that kind of context. You're trying to be closer to maintenance or a small surplus to be in maybe the 600 to 1,000 calorie range for your typical average energy intake in the refeeding context during bodybuilding contest prep for a male bodybuilder in these kind of body weight ranges, if I was to make some guesses around what I would expect their TDEE to be. So really strong relationship showing that the better you were at intuitive eating, and specifically two subscales of it, how much confidence do you have in your hunger and satiety signals, and how aware of how food makes your body feel was what predicted those lower energy intakes. Now, those were moderate strengths relationships, but there was a very strong relationship with total intuitive eating. And then finally, the only other thing that was significantly related to how much energy intake was consumed was coping based on emotions. So someone's emotional coping strategies. And that had also some overlap with the overall intuitive eating scores. So those constructs are probably measuring some of the same thing. But essentially what this told us was that bodybuilders who were better at intuitive eating as a broad skill that I described earlier, who were more aware of their hunger and satiety cues, that interoceptive awareness component, and how food made their bodies feel, same thing, and those who were better at managing their emotions in stressful situations, were able to control their energy intake during the ad libitum periods. And conversely, those who were scoring more poorly, they were consuming closer to as high as, you know, just over 2,000 calories when I'm eyeballing these graphs, which again, I think is, I would call that probably a bad outcome, because it means if you're trying to not offset your energy intake, you're eating like a bird in those other 5 meals for the day.
Yeah, because that's 2,000 in the cheat meal.
Correct.
Not day.
Per day.
Yeah.
Not the refeed.
Yeah.
The cheat meal. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. So I think that's really interesting. And to full transparency, it completely supports my biases and my own personal experience. So there is some threat to, like, this is observation. Data, right? We haven't seen an intervention. We haven't said, hey, increasing interoceptive awareness makes better outcomes for bodybuilders. We're looking at relationships. So cards on the table, this absolutely, you know, confirms my biases in that I've seen bodybuilders get leaner with less stress, maintaining more muscle, and be able to better integrate it into their lives and have a more sustainable approach to the nutritional demands of contest prep and the stresses of it, who get better at these intuitive approaches. They're better at auto-regulating their energy. They don't have a strict macro target they hit no matter how they feel. With experience, which these were experienced competitors, like I said, they've all done on average 6 or 7 competitions. You know that, yes, contest prep is hard, but there's an amount that it should be hard. And that changes throughout the prep as you get leaner in different contexts. And sometimes, as my coach and colleague Alberto Nunez says, there should be like a banana behind, you know, break glass here, like there is, you know, to get the fire alarm. Like, okay, you're planning 1,500 calories and it should be a low day and it's going to be hard. You know, you're 12 weeks out, but you shouldn't feel like you're dying. And if you are, that's going to have knock-on effects on your training, your sleep, and it can quickly spiral out of control. So just have 150 calories for that large banana and you'd be surprised what 150 calories can make you feel like. The disproportionate benefit to just having a little bit extra energy when you are that low in terms of your energy availability and that far below your set point. There were numerous times during my last contest prep where the plan was, okay, we've got a 1,400 to 1,700 calorie range. That was my low intake range and a range of 10 to 12,000 steps, right? My plan was to go in, we're going to hit 1,400, we're going to hit 12,000 steps, we're going to dig today. Somewhere around noon, I'm like, this is not the way it should feel. This is Monday. I got to make it to Friday and I have some hard training in the next couple of days. And I, you know, broke the glass, grabbed the banana and only got my 10K steps for the day. And I was able to sleep. I recovered and like I reversed that course of what could have been a very bad week. But a less experienced Helms would have been like, no, let's drink blood and grind ourselves to dust because that's what bodybuilding is. Let's get hardcore. And some competitors who do that, like is seen in some of this data on binge eating, end up pushing themselves to the point where they actually do break during contest prep. Others, like myself, I don't cheat during contest prep, but the rebound after contest prep can get out of hand. Or maybe I just start to go against the values of me being a good, more holistic bodybuilder, and I don't treat people with kindness, or I'm less available to my students, or I start dropping off some of the chores and responsibilities I have in my life, or I'm just a shitty husband for the day because I'm just so, you know, stressed that my cognitive burden is taking up my emotional capacity and my empathy, or just my awareness, and I get oblivious to other people's needs. And that is, to me, worse in some ways than actually just having a binge. So something goes sideways when you go past your ability to cope with stress. And I think it's unsurprising that people who are more aware of when they're moving past their ability to cope with stress, and that people who are good with coping with the emotional response to stress, are those who were better able to modify their energy intake. And I just think that was a really fascinating finding. So what's the practical take home from this? I would say, yeah, if that describes you, maybe it's time to try some of these auto-regulated approaches or to implement refeeds, because it might, like the data shows, improve adherence and make the contest prep feel easier, help with appetite regulation. And conversely, if you're at a stage where you're heavily rigid, heavily weighed, tracked, planned, and you experience anxiety going off of fixed numbers, and previously intermittent dieting strategies have led to binge eating for you, then maybe at least for now, that is something you should probably not use as a strategy, regardless of how common refeeds are. And if there's anything to be done from this, which we need more research to confirm, developing better interoceptive awareness, stress management techniques, and the ability to auto-regulate your energy intake and be more flexible with your nutrition in various environments are skills you should work on so you can potentially get the benefits that we've been observing about intermittent dieting in the future.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And it kind of, like you were saying, it kind of confirms some of my biases as well, but in a weird way. So like when the earliest like refeed and diet break data were starting to come out, you know, I was probably a little more bullish on it than I am now, or at least I would, you know, I had a little bit more optimism about some of the physiological aspects of refeeds and diet breaks. I still think, you know, there's a time and a place for them. I'm not anti refeed or diet break, but I have changed, you know, my position a bit as more data have come out. But there was a time where I would argue on behalf of them based on physiological grounds. And people would say, cool, well, how do you do them when you're prepping? I say, oh, no, I don't do those. And they're like, you just spent 45 minutes on a podcast telling me why they work and they're good. And I was like, yeah, I mean, for me, psychologically, it's just not good for me. I don't like it. And so for me, the downsides of my kind of psychological response to them wasn't even close to being worth it when you compare it to the, at that time, what I thought were very fascinating physiological effects. So yeah, I think with any kind of diet strategy, especially in bodybuilding, the psychology of bodybuilding is weird. I mean, it just is. It is a really unique thing. The closest thing I've seen in the literature is that one fantastic review paper about the Minnesota starvation study. And it was like, they starve so others would be fed or something like that in the title. But there was a cool review paper where they talked about some of the really extreme psychological responses to the Minnesota starvation study or starvation experiment. And that's the closest thing I've seen. Things where people are like, you know, hoarding food items or even hoarding cooking equipment or eating a dozen packs of gum a day or just hanging out at the grocery store to look around. You know, like some of these things that we see. So bodybuilding psychology is a field unto itself. It's its whole little thing. But I know for me personally, I was at a spot the last time I prepped where I wasn't where you are, Helms, in terms of saying, oh, yeah, I can manage this intuitively and, you know, do some of this, do some of that. For me, it was a lot easier to say, here's what I'm eating every day. Sometimes it's going to feel good. Sometimes it's going to feel not so good. Let's just stick with it. So I don't think that either one is necessarily better or worse. I mean, it would be great to have that flexibility and better coping and things like that. But I do think it's really important, you know, aside from kind of an idealistic perspective, in a very practical way, it's important to know yourself and it's important to know where you are. You know, so for someone like me who was in that spot, it would have been detrimental for me to say, well, why don't I throw these refeeds in and just hope I rise to the occasion? It would be much better to say, not ready for it yet. Let's do this prep, you know, the way that suits me now. But let's make sure in the long term, we're thinking about how we build up some of these skills, some of this flexibility, get better with intuitive eating. It's a long-term goal that is worth pursuing, but you don't want to throw a mismatch in there and say, well, I know I'm not ready for this, but it'd be cool if I was. You know, that's really not how you do it.
No, that's very well said, Trex. And I think in the example, and of course, correct me if I'm being too presumptuous to maybe describe the experience of what it might have been like doing it wrong for you, would be like, hey, I have a certain level of confidence and moving and comfortability with eating my foods at these times in this manner and hitting these calorie intakes. And once I've locked in and I have to track it, it's kind of easy. You know, I got my meal plan and I know that it's going to get me shredded on time and I experience what I experience and I'll deal with it because I'm good at coping with it. And interestingly enough, there are some elements of the strengths of these participants that you have. You know, I don't need to track it because I know it's the same thing every day. So, you know, and I'm good at managing my own emotional stress. And let me worry about it. But I'm not going to throw a wrench in the gear and take myself out of my comfort zone. And I think to some degree that self-awareness is really useful. And I think asking you to be intuitive and adaptive and think about how do I feel constantly and what am I eating, it introduces an unknown quantity that's going to independently, just doing that is going to create anxiety. And it makes you be more cognitively aware of the process.
Yeah.
Which isn't a fun process at times.
Yeah.
You know? So I think when implementing this strategy, you have to consider the personality of the person. So while for me, you can just say, hey, I want you just to think about how you feel. And it's more of a qualitative descriptor, you know, modify your energy intake. But there still were some quantitative guidelines. And I like 1400, 1700, you know? And I think you can play that card more strongly or less strongly, you know? Like with an even less quantitative, analytical-minded person than me, you could not even necessarily give them a range, if so long as they have this skill set. with someone like you, I was thinking about this when we talked previously about how, you know, like you don't want to have a coach because you want to control your things and some of your just your personality. It's like, you know, if I was going to have Trexler do this, I'd give very specific guidance. You know, I want you to rate your lethargy, your performance. I would give you some quantitative rating scales for certain key characteristics that you would say, like, okay, post-workout or pre-workout, what is my lethargy? After my meals that I'm eating, just how hungry do I feel right now? You only have to think about it for a second. It's like the RPE after a set.
Yeah.
And then if today, and we know that the reasonable expectation for this late stage of contest prep is to feel X amount of shitty. But if I'm X plus two, I'm going to have a banana.
Yeah.
You know, so it'd be very clear and it would be automated and there would be a, like a flow chart to get you there. And that strategy I would be designing in partnership with you to try to go right. Let's minimize all the potential downsides of taking an auto-regulated kind of ad libitum refeed cheat meal approach. But also, like we both acknowledged in an idealistic manner, if I was a different person than Eric Trexler, I might be able to benefit from this, but I'm not a different person. So how can we tailor an approach that gets us to the same place, but doesn't give you that sense of anxiety or lack of control? Like, yeah. You know that there's going to be a flow chart to follow. It may have an extra step than your normal day, but let's find a step that's worth you not feeling like trash.
Yeah.
You know? And if it's not worth it, we don't do it.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's also interesting because it wasn't even, and now I'm just on the therapy couch here for everyone listening at home, but it wasn't that I felt like I needed the control. The thing that comes to mind for me in mass, I wrote an article a while ago about mindfulness. And, you know, I've run in some Buddhist circles, some tough crowds of folks, obviously, where a lot of folks, usually not the practitioners, usually folks who are just kind of along for the ride there, part of the gang, who really believe deep down more mindfulness is always better. And what you find in the research, and a lot of skilled practitioners in Buddhism will say, well, wait a minute, not necessarily. Mindfulness is a tool. And just like arousal, there's kind of that inverted U. You want to have the right amount of mindfulness, but maybe not too much mindfulness. You know, you want to be amped up for a set when appropriate, but not always cranked up to 11 for every repetition, right? And so for me during contest prep, the fact that I needed to bring extra attention to how crappy I'm feeling or how little I'm eating was putting me on the wrong side of that mindfulness peak where I was like, well, now I'm just thinking about this way too much. And I'm getting too deep in the feelings of, wow, this sucks. So for me, it was almost like I stepped back and said, well, I know what it's going to take to get down there. I can just set this on, you know, cruise control, do what I'm supposed to do, and think about my research because I was working on my PhD at the time. So the last wrinkle I'll throw into this conversation is, and you alluded to this, when you're thinking about implementing refeeds and you're thinking about the potential pros and cons, there should be room in that conversation for saying, maybe we don't do it. Like, you know, because like for me, if my lack of doing it, it's not like I was like, man, I'm just obsessing over controlling this and my life is completely out of hand. I'm, you know, living by the clock for every meal. I'm missing out on social events. I'm not getting my work done because I'm upset. It was actually the opposite. I was like, I don't want to worry about all that crap. Like, I'm good, you know?
Yep.
And so it's really important to think through, like, the way that you're doing it now, if you don't include refeeds, is there a problem or is that working for you, right? Because that could look very, very different. There could be someone who's saying, I couldn't imagine going, you know, adding 15 carbs on a Thursday. That wasn't the situation I was in. It was more just, if I'm adding this, then I'm worrying about reducing that. And what if I'm adding too much? Then I got to recalculate some crap. Who cares? You know, I'm just going to eat my stuff. So it's really fascinating. I don't want to go on too much of a me-focused tangent, but I do think it's interesting to talk through some of these scenarios for folks because when it comes to bodybuilding, there's so many ways to do it, and just dieting in general. There's so many ways to do it, and we focus so much on the physiology sometimes that we don't leave room for different psychological profiles. You know, I reviewed an article in Mass a while back where they did, you know, it was a weight loss intervention. Some folks, they did diet plus exercise right out of the gates. For some folks, their hypothesis was, wait a minute, let's get them dieting for like 6 months. And then at the 6 month mark, we throw in the exercise. So they start easier. When that stuff starts slowing down a little bit, now we bring in the next level of the intervention. And to their surprise, that backfired because people got used to dieting and said, well, this sucks. And then they said, wait, you're going to make it harder now? Like now that I'm 6 months into this. And the folks who started out and just said, let's crank it up and do it when motivation is highest, they cruised right through it. And they had better long-term outcomes in that trial at the one-year mark and beyond. So yeah, sometimes psychology, different people have different responses, and it's not always intuitive. You know, I talked about this in one of my most recent articles where I said, you know, we in fitness, we talk about sustainable interventions, but we never really, you know, back up what we're claiming to be sustainable. Sometimes we use that as shorthand for the easiest in the short term and assume that that's going to be something that we sustain in the long term. And while that's intuitive and makes sense, it also discounts some of the more complex elements of sustained motivation, right? So bit of a tangent there, but yeah, I really love this article that you did on refeeds because I think the more we dig into it, we're really starting to figure out more about what refeeds do, what they don't do, where they apply, where they don't apply, and in this case, for whom would they be most advantageous?
No, that's a great summary and all really good points. And yeah, I literally could talk about this for another hour, but I won't.
Yeah.
Because I know we have a lot of good questions in the chat that we should probably dig into.
Yeah. Before we get into the questions, though, got to get the hashtags. Trextopia, yes. Helms Haven, absolutely. Trexcendental Meditation, Helm in Hand, Lord of Helms.
Oh.
Someone put this hashtag, 99% of iron culture. That is an interesting perspective that we
shots fired.
May need to run that by our dear friend Omar. So
she's got the team ones, Eric to the second power, and Team Eric, which I'm a big fan of because that's you know, mutual appreciation.
Trexcalibur, that's pretty good. That's a new one.
That is good.
Yeah. All right, Helm. So we're gonna try to do this. We say we're going to. We never live up to it, but we're gonna really do it this time. We're going to do some quick rapid fire in the chat, give people what they came for. Got a question from Jacob. What are your thoughts on Menno's fat loss sprints? Short periods of time with very large deficits with frequent maintenance periods. Does reducing your total time in a deficit have any advantage? And to give a fair shout out, the first I ever heard of, I'm not saying who came up with it first. There could be a war raging for all I know. I do know that I heard about Lane Norton saying things about fat loss sprints a while ago as well. So who knows who gets the official trademark on that? But Helms, what do you think?
There is actually some preliminary data because when I first did the muscle and strength videos and I said there's a theoretical basis for refeeds, this is long before any of the refeed stuff really came out. We're talking 2012. There was a few of the 5 and 2 studies that I said, hey, not that type of 5 and 2. And you're probably like, I don't even know what you're talking about. There is some data on using a 5 and 2 strategy where you have 2 days that are basically either complete fasting or only eating 500, 800 calories, where they had slightly better body composition outcomes. That was then later meta-analyzed and systematically reviewed multiple times in the, you know, the subsequent 12 years. And it didn't really shake out to having clear advantages. But there are some studies. It's typically almost always neutral to positive. I will say that about some of these kind of 5 and 2 approaches. So I think that there is undoubtedly some degree of both the size of the deficit and the absolute degree of energy availability, but also the time course. Because we do see that going on a really, really big deficit or a really big surplus at slightly different time courses can have differential physiological effects. There was a study showing that a one-day refeed in women did not restore LH pulsatility, even though they're in a really big surplus, on average about 4,500 calories. This is a study done back in the 90s. And then when you look at another one where they did a three-day period at maintenance, that actually was the same cumulative amount of energy intake over that period and same cumulative deficit prior to it, just done in different ways, that actually did restore LH pulsatility which is an early marker for oligomenorrhea or a change or a irregularity to one's typical menstrual cycle. So that's obviously not the same thing as, will this help with, you know, fat loss or body recomposition, but I think it's certainly viable. And I don't think it should be taken off the table. And it's certainly an approach one could take. I just think you need to go back to everything Trek said about 10 minutes ago about the psychology of the individual person and how you want to apply it, because I don't think it should be like a blanket approach by any means.
Yeah. Now, the version of fat loss sprints that I'd heard of, rather than being like 5 days at normal and then 2 days of very low intake, it was more like, why don't you do like more of like a mini cut, like a 2 week cut, and then maybe 4 weeks. It may, I forget the exact numbers, but is there a certain, when you start going from 2 days to 2 weeks, do you have any reservations about being in such a large deficit for that type of time period?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, the data we have on just looking at diets with shorter or faster weight loss periods, where you're getting to the same amount of weight loss. That's actually some of Ina Garth's or Garta's research. When you look at those comparison of fast to short weight loss, you actually do see better lean mass retention for the same amount of total weight loss, getting there slower versus faster. So I think you do need to consider that. And I think you especially need to consider it as you get leaner, because then you've got a lot of conflicting signals.
Yeah, I agree. I do think the leaner you get, that's where you really have to get a little bit more selective about the size of your deficit, the timeline of the cut, things like that. Yep. Roxy said, it must be discouraging to be sports medicine scientist, too sciencey for the typical gym bro, but at the same time, being too bro-ish to others, you know, maybe the scientists out there. Helms, how do you feel about that?
Honestly, I think you should listen to the most recent Iron Culture episode. We just had Dr. Pack on, and he talked about some of the kind of gatekeeping that is going on, where you're getting flack from people in the science community who don't think you should be using memes because it's not professional enough. But then you're getting flack from people within the community who think, you know, that you're not giving enough nuance around the science, or you're being too black and white on either side of it. And I think it's actually very challenging right now to strike the right balance. I would encourage everyone to listen to this episode. I, in that podcast, primarily talked about the actual measured and researched phenomenon called the Sagan effect, which comes from the science communicator Carl Sagan, who is kind of like the Neil deGrasse Tyson of the 80s and 90s, and actually quite literally The Cosmos, which is a great show that's narrated about how the universe was formed. It was redone in modern form with modern, you know, visual effects by Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Wasn't Sagan his, wasn't he his mentor?
Carl Sagan might have been Neil deGrasse Tyson's mentor.
I think it might have been the case. Someone will correct us if I'm wrong.
I think you might be right. But I think the really interesting thing is that Carl Sagan got denied being part of a specific astrophysicist's society for people who've done good research, and also got denied tenure, despite the fact that when you looked at his CV, he was on par with other members and people who had gotten tenure. And this was because science communication was deemed as kind of lowbrow. Mm-hmm. And it was seen as, oh, you're taking time away. You're not doing this for the love of the game. You're doing it to promote yourself. And when this is actually researched, they found that researchers, this has been done multiple times and replicated, researchers who engage with more media outlets and have more posts on social media, this has been researched all the way up to 2016 and maybe changing with the social media landscape, actually on average have about a 10% higher research output and impact on average.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are also people like Andrew Huberman, right? So this is not a blanket statement that, hey, the most visible person out there in their field is therefore great, but there's expert creep there as well. But on average, the person who does more science communication is actually doing more in terms of their scientific work. And it also could be a chicken or egg thing here. Like, if you produce more research, you're probably going to be asked to be on more podcasts. You're going to be asked to get more opportunities to make social media posts. You have more stuff to talk about.
Right.
But it's a really interesting podcast. I'd encourage you to listen to it. And we talk specifically about this topic. And I think you'd find it fascinating if that's where your head was at, Roxy.
All right, Helms, question about refeeds. If you're not a competitive athlete, you just want to stay kind of lean, Would it be a good strategy to eat in a calorie deficit and have refeeds all year round? So instead of just chilling at maintenance, being in a slight deficit most days and then having some refeeds to kind of round things out.
I'm going to give a really non-answer answer to this. If it's easier, yes. But I don't think you're, because of the individual psychology of this, you're not going to know. So here's one example of how it could be easier. One of the main reasons that I think intermittent fasting took off is that most people wake up, get into work, don't want to think about food, and want to start their day. And then when they get home, they like to eat larger dinners and feel full. And it wasn't necessarily a physiological effect. And we've seen multiple times that when you have an 8-hour period of restriction, or sorry, an 8-hour eating window, it leads to total energy restriction and people are able to lose weight and probably maintain some degree of weight loss on average. That is an and then if you did that, and then you're typically your schedule changes on the weekend and you allow yourself to have a bit of a refeed on the weekend, that is kind of like the accidental pattern of people that they have used for IF to maintain weight. And there's a ton of people anecdotally who will share that with you.
Yeah.
Other people use that exact same strategy and end up finding themselves feeling restricted throughout the week, and their weekends blow up and they go even harder and they actually gain weight and it turns into some kind of pseudo bulimia. Those things are both true, using the same approach, and the rationale does not make sense for some, it makes sense for others. Because the data on binge eating is very clear that restriction is what predicts binge eating, I think one needs to be very, very mindful of what this could turn into. But hypothetically, especially if it's not too restrictive on those low days and you're not actually in a state of low energy availability and your net outcome is maintenance, I think that's probably fine. And I will state that the natural state of humans who are weight stable is not maintenance every single day. It is cumulative maintenance. And I think most people who are weight stable, they find themselves in a slight deficit on some days and a slight surplus on other days. And maybe they have a big, big meal and go out with their friends and family on Saturday and they have a 4,000 calorie day and they're just less hungry on Sunday and Monday. That is for people who have pretty good interoceptive awareness, self-regulation, and some, frankly, physiological genetic determinants that aren't that modifiable, that are stronger than the environmental signals, which is not the case for most people, unfortunately, that even though you had that large pizza on Saturday, you're going to end up in maintenance at the end of the week if your weight's stable.
Yeah.
So it's not a complete deviation from what is normal, really, when you think about it. So this can work. But I think it can also be a formula that is not great for other people. And I think you would need to be mindful, be aware of who you are. Like Trex was talking about, know thyself and go into this kind of eyes wide open, not just listening to what really worked well for other people on the internet, but thinking about how this would apply to your lifestyle.
Yeah. I do think it's really fascinating. This is a bit of a tangent, but thinking through the mathematics of obesity progression, I've seen some really fascinating articles that kind of talk through like, okay, so someone eats a big pizza on Monday and then they're less hungry on Tuesday and Wednesday, right? And for the most part, yeah, those people end up being like approximately an energy balance. So for most fitness people, we say, hey, if I maintain my body weight over the next year effortlessly within plus or minus a kilogram, I'm at maintenance. I'm weight stable, right? Uh-huh. But there is some really fascinating obesity focused research that says like, hey, when in the fitness world, our idea about weight change is warped, right? We think about that time that we lost 25 pounds, the time we gained 35 when we were bulking, like we've completely lost our like barometer. It's totally completely like miscalibrated based on all these crazy weight fluctuations that we tend to do over the course of our career. But it's fascinating to think that for many people, they do a pretty good job when they have that pizza on Monday, eating less on Tuesday and Wednesday, not because of effort, but because their body's just less hungry, but they're just a little bit in a surplus over that 3-day period. And it really is it's fascinating to see some of the modeling where people say most people gain about a kilogram a year and they just keep doing it. Right. And so it's like you're only off by a very small percentage in terms of calibrating that energy balance. But if you do that for 75 years, you know, you start to see how the population body fat percentage continues to rise a little bit. You know, it's really fascinating to watch. But anyway, I think the math on that is fantastic because it kind of recalibrates how I view some of these. Like sometimes I like to tell people, let's think about your next million calories, because people eat about 900,000, maybe a million calories a year. And so whenever I feel someone slipping into a situation where they're really way too stressed out about the short term and this strategy versus that strategy, I think, which is going to have the biggest impact on our next million calories? Because we're, you know, for someone who's not, you know, really doing a dedicated cut or bulking phase, are we going to gain that kilogram or not over our next million? You know, I think it helps people kind of come back to the numbers that matter a little bit more. But Helms, let's get a training question in here. This is a good one. So
let's go.
Neural adaptations, and we're specifically talking about hypertrophy here. So when we move to a new exercise, we expect that there's going to be some neural adaptations that happen in those first several weeks. And so maybe you decide you want to stick with an exercise for a while, get through those neural adaptations, and then, you know, see your kind of true hypertrophy related progression once that dissipates and you make that slower incremental strength increase over time. The question is, could we assume that professional bodybuilders may have a shorter window of neurological adaptations since nothing's really new to them? You know, they've pretty much mastered resistance training, broadly speaking. You know, and kind of a side note on the question, the idea of exercises being cycled so often with bodybuilders always seemed unnecessary, but maybe at that level, the useful life of an exercise could be substantially shorter, and maybe they can kind of cycle through exercises without a big period of neural adaptation. So I guess kind of a broad response to that cluster of statements and questions.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree, and I think this is exercise specific.
Yeah,
And I know this quite well because I have, for the vast majority of my career, been a strength sport and physique sport athlete concurrently, and I've worked with many people with a similar goal. And I can tell you that coming back to a cable row, coming back to a dumbbell bicep curl, coming back to a machine chest press, is very different than coming back to a sumo deadlift, a competition squat, or an arched, you know, heavy bench press with max legal width grip while trying to get leg drive. And it is not uncommon for me to have lost no muscle mass or even gained muscle mass in my quads, glutes, lower back, and have been increasing my leg press, increasing my RDL, going through a bodybuilding phase, increasing my leg extension, increasing my leg scroll, increasing my hip thrust, increasing my weighted back extension, looking more muscular in my lower body, and then coming back to squats and being 25, 30 kilos down from my previous peak. And that for me is like a 10, 15% lower top end strength. And it will take me 6 weeks or so of doing specific training, or longer, 6 to 8 weeks, of just doing like a single and just like a 9 RPE, if I was to do that every other day on a squat, which I've quite literally done, to get back to where I was. So that tells you a lot about what's an appropriate vehicle to kind of leverage this supposition. And this is also supported by a study that I reviewed in Mass way back, and I think an issue in the first couple of issues by Rausch and colleagues on auto-regulated exercise selection, I think it was done back in 2017, where they had experienced lifters just choosing from a list worth from three exercises for each one of the muscle groups they trained 3 days per week. And the auto-regulated group, which just selected exercises when they wanted, actually made better gains. And this is it's a complex intervention. It's not specifically looking at intervening and doing different times away from an exercise. But there's also research on untrained women that was done in the 90s where they compared leg press, bench press, and bicep curls. And they looked at 12 weeks of training, and they did mid-testing at the six-week mark. And they found that the trunk and the limbs had not actually experienced hypertrophy, but the arms had, indicating that the bicep curl that they were doing had a much shorter window for sufficient neural adaptations to overload the muscular system to induce hypertrophy, while the leg press and the bench press had not experienced any growth yet, and they only observed increases in pec and quadricep hypertrophy at the 12-week mark, showing that there is differences based upon the skill factor of these movements. So to answer your question, Ben, I would say there are some movements which you will need to be aware of and plan for a longer arc of neural readaptation, even in a professional bodybuilder. like myself. Like, I wouldn't go, let me do a 3-week block of squats. I think all that would do would give me subpar adaptation on the squats below what would actually stress those muscular systems. It wouldn't be, of course, wasted time, but I would need to be regrooving that pattern. And then if I cycled it out, it would be incomplete, and that would probably be suboptimal. However, on a leg press, I can tell you that by that third week, I would probably be back up. And on a bicep curl, the first set. You know, so I think you just need to be aware of those factors.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree. Another training question here. So where'd it go? Someone was asking about your views on progression. Yeah, so curious about Helms' ideas on progression. Your practice seems to have changed away from wave loading to a top single and auto-regulated back-offs. No longer dual undulating periodization. So basically, you've changed over time. You're not the same man you used to be. What's going on with your views on progression, and how have they changed and why?
But have I?
Mm.
Chris, great question. And I would say that there are still actually elements of both DUP and wave loading that are built into auto-regulated top singles and back-offs in my typical programming. The singles, I will typically do them in a fashion where they are attached to different DUP model days. And while they are auto-regulated, they're auto-regulated within a range.
Are you still doing top singles right now?
I'm not, because I'm only training for bodybuilding.
Right.
But very recently, back in 2023, and during my last real big run at powerlifting, which is in 2021, I would have a volume day. But it would start with a single.
Yeah.
And that single would be at a moderate RPE, like 6 to 8. And then I would do back off sets in the like 4 to 8 rep range. And I would accumulate multiple sets of back offs. So there's our hypertrophy day, but preceded by a single.
Yeah.
The value of the single is I get an estimated 1 RM from that. So I have my finger on the pulse of where's my estimated strength. The next day I do squats, I would come in and only do a single. And it would also be at a moderate RPE. This is kind of that power day that allows recovery from the volume day. And then the next time I came in and squatted, I would do a heavy single in a state of recovery that was facilitated by that single, which is our quote-unquote power day, if you will. And then my back-offs would actually be, say, 3x3 versus 4x8.
Right.
And then the next block, I would kick up the RPE range and drop off some of those numbers of back-off sets. So we still, and it might be wave loaded. I might go from 4 sets of 8 to 4 sets of 7 on that volume day to 4 sets of 6. And they would still have RPE targets attached to them. And the benefit of doing this is that we can maintain some of those theoretical periodization models, which do the big picture blocks, which most people agree on are beneficial. You know, we're maintaining sufficient volume to maintain muscle size. We are getting sufficient practice, but not so much that's impeding the recovery and hopefully maybe even priming performance for that day where we come in and we go heavy. So we follow that kind of DUP model. And we're also seeing intensity go up, specificity go up as we're getting closer to the point where we need to be our strongest and actually perform on the platform. And while we're decreasing the dose of volume and non-specific work to be sufficient to maintain the adaptations which support strength, but are not acutely key factors for expressing strength on game day. So what might start as a single at a 6 and 4 sets of 8 at 80% of that single might finish as a single at 8.5 and 3 sets of 5 at 80% of that single, or probably not 80%, but something like that on that kind of day one of that DUP model. So they are actually still working in concert. And I think this will be something I can express and articulate better in the third edition of the Muscle and Strength Pyramids, which is probably going to come out towards the end of this year.
Very exciting. Well, I'll tell you what, Helms, we've had a lot of folks in the chat who mentioned this is their first time joining us live. Maybe my internet didn't drop. We just crashed YouTube from having this huge influx of viewers who I often say is typically every night between 100 and 100,000 is usually the range that we fall in when we do a live episode. So thanks to everyone who's joining us live for the very first time. The cliche is, I swear this never happens. We usually don't have the stream drop in the middle. It's the first time it's happened. And Hopefully we'll have much more success technologically in the future. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll stick with us here. Question for, actually, I wanted to address a couple ones really quick here. One of them, yes, so there was one that said, love to know if you had any thoughts about how to measure and evaluate cortisol levels to see if things are getting worse and how to measure that. I actually would not advise measuring cortisol unless you are under the direct care of a physician or otherwise qualified medical professional who was under the impression that you had a medical condition pertaining to cortisol levels. You know, so there may be clinical reasons to test cortisol in a controlled manner in order to rule out certain pathologies or medical conditions. But for a person who's interested in their health and fitness and does not believe that they have any specific medical condition, I actually would not advise measuring it. It is something that's susceptible to diurnal variation, so changes throughout the day. So you have to be really particular about timing, not just in terms of time on the clock, but also your kind of circadian rhythm. So there needs to be a level of consistency to make any kind of inferences. And cortisol is very fickle. It changes a lot throughout the day. If you get all anxious about, you know, pricking your finger or poking your vein to get the cortisol, you might be influencing cortisol by having that little nervous response. So I really don't recommend measuring it. When I measure it as a researcher, I prefer to use actually hair. So I'm doing that in a study right now where we're collecting hair samples and we're going to be looking at cortisol. And that gives you a look at average cortisol levels over months, right? So you can get a very broad picture of, are you someone who generally has higher cortisol than your peers? But that's just so
Chris,
that we can
ask you a question.
Sure.
Hey, so cortisol, stress hormone, stress is bad. Wouldn't it be good if I could just produce no cortisol? What would happen, Trex, if my body produced no cortisol? That'd be good, right?
That'd be catastrophic. Absolutely terrible. Yeah, so cortisol, we need it. We need it to function properly as a human being. We certainly need it to exercise. Cortisol is important. It does important things. And the reason that we have that diurnal variation is to keep everything working right. Okay, so when cortisol gets out of whack, too high, too low, we start to see like real clinical manifestations and symptoms. So all that is to say there are reasons to test it, but usually only when directed by a qualified medical professional, or if you're doing a research study and you're taking other indicators of stress and trying to kind of make those connections. And the thing with hair, if you're an aspiring researcher, even that's tough, man. Like, you know, we're going to have missing data because you need to have ideally at least 2 or 3 centimeters of hair. It's got to be taken from the right side, the correct location on the scalp. Like for me, I couldn't even give a hair sample, obviously. Helms, your hair might be too short back there to give a hair sample.
It might be.
So yeah, hair samples are tricky and you can't just take it from anywhere. It really does need to be on a certain part of the scalp. So, I work with folks in evolutionary anthropology who do a lot of research in, various, they do research all over the world. They do field work, right? So they might be going into a rural location in South America or some parts of Africa where there are cultural norms where like literally no one has 3 centimeters of hair, right? Like it's just not how they maintain their hair within that culture. And so, yeah, hair cortisol can be really tricky. There's a lot of details you got to sort out if you're doing that research. But for the average person, I really wouldn't bother measuring cortisol. Another question from the same person, Helms. They asked if you had talked with Mike Israetel about issues related to supplementation and contamination and the CGMP certification. So didn't you record a whole podcast on that with Mike?
Yep, he's referring to it. He said, you talked with Mike Israetel about the issues of supplementation in terms of contamination. Would you trust the certified GMP certification? Curious. Yeah, important distinction. So very clear here that if you were talking about certified GMP and there is an actual certification by a third party who came by and said, yep, you've got everything labeled the right way, you are following general manufacturing practices, I would trust that to the extent of what it means.
Right.
And that is very different from seeing just the GMP symbol on a supplement, because technically all supplements produced in the U.S. need to follow the general manufacturing practices. That's a legal requirement that no one basically checks on. Occasionally, the FDA will do it every few years and just do a random inspection to see the state of the industry. And yeah, you'll get in trouble if you don't follow GMP. But more than likely, if you never had your manufacturing plant certified GMP, there would be no consequences. It's a very low probability that you're going to get flagged by the random testing the FDA does. And in fact, in 2013, a random testing sample of manufacturing supplement facilities in the U.S. found 70% of them did not meet the GMP standards. So you can put GMP on your label, and you're basically just saying, trust us. But what you're probably looking for, one of the more common ones, is USP, certified GMP. There's others, of course. And I would, like I said, I would trust that to the extent of what it means. And all it means is that the manufacturing plant where that supplement is made follows the legally required general manufacturing practices. It does not mean that they're testing for banned substances or that they're ensuring that the shipping of them, or that once it is shipped to the actual supplement producer, that they're not modifying the product advertently or inadvertently. Is advertently a word? Purposely or inadvertently?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never heard it without the in attached to it.
Got to be some archaic version of the word.
Yeah.
Hashtag advertently. So, but it will tell you that they're doing things the way they should be done, and that should theoretically result in a lower likelihood of contamination due to manufacturing practices. But that won't prevent any other potential sources of contamination. And if this is a really important thing for you to make sure that there is not contaminants in your supplements, then you want to actually get a third party who is testing those batches and specific supplements you're taking to see that they only have what the label claims.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, whenever you're seeing those labels with third-party certification, it's really important to make sure you understand exactly what they are doing, right? Because there's, like you said, different tiers. Sometimes just looking at the factory, you're good to go with your manufacturing practices. Sometimes it's saying, okay, we tested for heavy metals and you know, toxins, right? And things like that. And then sometimes there are those kind of high-tier certifications where they say, this has everything it says, it has nothing it doesn't say, and we checked it against WADA, and if you're an athlete, go ahead, right? So
yep.
Very different tiers of certification and testing there. Helms, I think we got time for one more question. We've had lovely engagement from the live chat. Really appreciate that, folks. Someone mentioned that they just hit the like button. Yuppie down there said, I've clicked the like button, and hey, that's a really great idea. If you're mm-hmm. joining us before you exit tonight and make your way safely home, make sure you hit the like button. That's technically the cost of admission, is you do have to hit the like button. Otherwise, you may lose access. I've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Helms, last question here from Peter. So Peter says, I've been interested in the differences/similarities between contest bodybuilding, recreational/Instagram bodybuilding, and general weight loss. Do you view these on a spectrum, or do you view them as completely distinct groups? Helms, what do you think?
I view them as distinct groups, but I think they can all lay claim to the title of bodybuilder. I'm not precious about that, nor do I even think it's necessarily something to be like super proud of. It's your identity, you know, like
if you had certified bodybuilder.
Yeah, exactly. I want a third party tester to come in. Some people, I think, sure, like there's very few people who are actually going to get on stage, and it's very challenging to do, and it does self-select, but there's a lot of things that self-select that very few people can do or would do that aren't necessarily things that are all good, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, there are distinct differences here. The big difference, if we're looking at kind of, say, let's say Instagram bodybuilding or recreational bodybuilding versus competitive bodybuilding, is that some of the behaviors of competitive bodybuilding or the processes are not necessarily optimal for putting on muscle, like dieting down to have shredded glutes. That's a great way to lose some muscle, you know, The status that you're in by the time you get below your lower intervention point and the cumulative energy deficit and the things you've had to do to get there are directly counterproductive to building muscle, which might seem ironic, you know? So if you were to take two people, twins, and one of them spent their whole time above their lower intervention point doing milder cuts, just kind of getting beach lean, and then spending the rest of the time being in, you know, a surplus and doing everything they can to build muscle, and the other person was a competitive bodybuilder, and assuming they could both muster up the same level of motivation, which I will admit competing in bodybuilding can be a little spark in the gas tank, which is great, the person who would probably be bigger earlier in their lifetime career would be the people who are not dieting the point where they're hypogonadal, right?
Right.
So I think that is something to be acknowledged. And the bulking and cutting cycles that bodybuilders do are required. You don't get to be shredded without going through a purposeful cut. And you don't get to recover from getting shredded without going into a purposeful surplus. And I think that's one of those practices that is inherited that is not necessarily required, or at least not to the same extreme degree, by recreational bodybuilders. And I think recreational bodybuilders generally also should have a different standard for what they consider quote-unquote lean. And I would say kind of like the holy grail for a competitive bodybuilder is to be striated glutes on stage, well-peaked, having preserved as much muscle mass as possible, symmetrical, and going, yeah, I crushed that prep. The off-season worked. I looked better than last time, and that's awesome. The holy grail for a recreational bodybuilder is probably to be able to build a whole bunch of muscle and then sustain a healthy level of the lowest body fat for them that they can walk around with without having negative consequences. And that is, of course, individually defined. You're like, you're not always food focused. Maybe you're a little bit food focused, but you're okay with it. I'm not going to tell people how to live it. Why?
You don't have like a foggy memory. You can focus, you know, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. If you look at the 2023 IOC and British Journal of Sports Medicine REDS and low energy availability position stand, this would be, at worst, an adaptive low energy availability state, right? It's something that's not producing substantial symptoms of REDS. But basically, you are able to enjoy the fruits of your labor in either case. The bodybuilder then is going to go, well, great. Okay, I was shredded. It's time to get back up to something sustainable. However, the recreational bodybuilder goes, awesome. Now I've got a walk around physique, and you need to spend much more time, focus, and energy thinking about what does maintenance look like? And then finally, weight loss is the active phase of losing weight. And I think it's really important to kind of link back and make this practical that the behaviors associated with success during the acute weight loss phase are not one and the same with weight maintenance. And this has been empirically shown. There is some overlap, but not a whole lot. And the reason why most people, one of the reasons why most people unfortunately regain their lost weight is they don't necessarily incorporate a lot of the behaviors and the perspective and the changes to their, or maintain certain changes to their lifestyle, which are associated with successful long-term weight loss maintenance. And they will lose that same 25 pounds three or four times before they eventually define their self-efficacy is eroded. They've had negative effects of weight cycling and they give up. So I think that wasn't exactly the question, but you are modifying your body composition in all three cases purposefully for hopefully, you know, good reasons in a healthy way within the context of your goal. And that's where they are similar, but the actual processes can be quite distinct. Someone who is purely interested in weight loss for health and reducing adipose tissue, maybe they have pre-diabetes, is going to use resistance training to prevent losses of lean mass, not because they want to have sick biceps.
Yeah.
But an Instagram bodybuilder or a competitive bodybuilder wants to have sick biceps. But a competitive bodybuilder wants to have sick biceps so bad that they're sicker than that guy's biceps or that gal's.
Yeah.
And they're willing to diet themselves down to unsustainably low levels of body fat to do so.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I'm just going to kind of riff on this and kind of add some other random thoughts to it, because I totally agree with what you covered. The kind of additions that I would make, or you know, the 2 cents that I'll throw into the mix, I think when it comes to distinguishing between these groups, and they are different, there are a few things that come to mind for me. One of them is, what approach to what they're doing would be considered appropriate based on which group that they fall in? Like, if you are getting general fat loss, like general population clients who just, their doctor said, hey, cholesterol, blood glucose, a little bit high, let's try to tighten up a little bit. If you're treating them like a bodybuilder in your coaching and having them do similar strategies, that's the kind of thing that, you know, it would make me say, you're just bad at this. Like, you're just not good at coaching, you know, and you shouldn't be doing it, really. Or you should really start back from square one and kind of rework the fundamentals. Like, if you're acting like, oh yeah, I just have my bodybuilding program, I'll just give it to you and we'll stop when you hit 35% body fat instead of 4.5. No, that's completely different, right?
Yeah.
And on the flip side, if I was, like, for example, reading a client intake form for someone who is applying to work with me, if I saw a competitive bodybuilder, oh yeah, I've done this, this, and this, I might say, yeah, that sounds like bodybuilding. If I hear someone that's in the general population talking about some of the extremes that bodybuilders go to in their prep, saying, yeah, this is what I've been doing the last few months, I'd probably spit out my water. You know, I mean, like, there are some things that competitive bodybuilders do, yep, in the interest of competing, that in other contexts, you would say, we shouldn't be doing that. It's kind of like how we always say, or at least I always say, some of these eating disorder questionnaires, if you give them to a bodybuilder, they're going to have red flag after red flag after red flag, because it's kind of, you know, for the general population, the expectations are completely different and the behaviors are completely different. A lot of just being a bodybuilder will put you in the clinical range on a lot of these questionnaires, even though you're doing it for competitive reasons and have no clinical body image dissatisfaction, right? So there's huge differences there. And then the other big difference that kind of comes to mind for me is, I'm like you, I don't have any interest in gatekeeping the
title,
the honored title of bodybuilder. If you want to be a bodybuilder, you're a bodybuilder. It's great. But I think what's really unique about choosing to have that title, like, what really separates a recreational bodybuilder with no intention to compete from the general population? And to me, it's a matter of intention and goals, but also a matter of community, right? So, like, I think back to the early days on the bodybuilding forums, back when that was the thing and people were doing it. And it's like, there were people on the bodybuilding forums who had no intention of ever competing, but they were bodybuilders because we were into the same stuff. We're doing the same things. There was a sense of community, a sense of identity. And identity isn't just about wanting to fit into the crowd. Identity can be really important. And I actually, in last month of Mass, I wrote a whole article about identity. And so, like, just to give an idea of what I mean, there were these two scales, exercise identity scale and healthy eater identity scale. And people would answer these. These four different prompts, engaging in sufficient exercise is something that fits the way I want to live. Engaging in sufficient exercise is something that fits who I am. I see myself as someone who engages in sufficient exercise. I am a typical person who engages in sufficient exercise. And then there are kind of analogous items related to eating healthy, right? So the research suggests that when you make fitness part of your identity and you do it in a constructive way, it can be something that's really powerful in terms of helping you identify what your goals are and really stick with those goals over time. Now, of course, it can backfire. If you make exercise or fitness your identity or bodybuilding your identity, and then you anchor your self-worth based on, you know, how you're doing as a bodybuilder, that's a problem, right? Because then what happens when you're in a car accident and you break your leg and you lose literally all your gains for 6 months? Well, if all your self-worth is tied up in your fitness identity and you're not fit anymore, as far as you can tell, you're worthless. And of course, that's not true, but that is the major issue that you set yourself up for if you don't approach this idea of identity and self-worth very, very cautiously and thoughtfully. So I think the big thing for me is that, you know, being a recreational, non-competitive bodybuilder is kind of a statement of intention and a statement of interest and a statement of identity. And that can be a really productive thing. And I've benefited greatly from the connections I've made with people who identify as bodybuilders, I really don't care if they compete. I think within that community, then you have kind of a sub-community that's fully contained within it of the people who say, hey, we're the ones crazy enough to actually do this on stage, right? And you kind of share that extra layer of connection where you've been through the, you know, the nerves backstage, and hey, stage was a lot brighter and hotter than I thought. And man, it's kind of hard to pose for 30, you know, for however long when you're doing prejudging. So it's a matter of community. And I think that folks who do gatekeep that term or that title should really think about, well, are you really sure that you want to have a really small tent, you know, a really tiny community? Like, it's nice when you can expand that out and kind of have a bigger, broader community and make more connections.
Draw circles, not borders, my friend.
Absolutely. So if you are a bodybuilder who's never competed and you never want to, that's just fine by me. And if nothing else, it's really helpful when, like Helms, you've coached a lot of people. I have too. When someone puts on their application form, just so you know, I'm basically a bodybuilder, but I don't plan to compete. That tells me a lot about what their goals are, what their motivations are, what would be an appropriate way to kind of handle their training and nutrition. So there are certainly similarities among all these different groups, but there are really key differences. And it's really important for you to know that, especially if you're going to be coaching people, of, you know, where does a person fall on what I would call a spectrum that does have some distinctions and discontinuities along the way.
Well said.
All right, Helms, I see we have Mike Zordos in the live chat, which tells me that it's probably time to wrap things.
Get out of here.
Yeah, when you look around and that's the company you see, it's probably time to pack things up. So I really appreciate everyone who joined us live on YouTube. Got some really great questions. Really enjoyed chatting with folks. And yeah, we do this every Wednesday night. If you haven't hit the like button, be sure to do that. After we sign off here, make sure you write a really, really great review wherever you get this podcast. Really appreciate everyone's questions. If you think of one, you say, ah, I should have asked it. Look in the description of this video. We've got the link to massresearchreview.com/officehours. Click on that, leave us a question, and we'll get to it. We'll try to get to it, hopefully, in a future episode. I'll be back in a week on Wednesday night. No idea who I'm with. Maybe Lauren, maybe Mike. I'll have to check the schedule. But either way, I'll be here. Another member of the Mass team will be here. It will be a fantastic evening. So put it on your calendar, and I look forward to seeing you then.